This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to New Books and Literary Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dan Moran. Jessica Houghton Wilson is the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University. She's the author of several books, including Giving the Devil His Due, Flannery O'Connor and the Brothers Karamazov, which received a 2018 Christianity Today Book of the Year and Arts and Culture Award. She's here today to talk about O'Connor again, this time her work as editor and midwife to Flannery O'Connor's third and sadly unfinished novel, Why Do the Heathen Rage? Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you. I haven't been called a midwife before. That's a new one.
I thought it was an apt metaphor. So we're going to start with a big, long, but necessary question, and then we'll kind of go backwards. And here's what it is. I want to set this up. So in 2013, they published Vladimir Nabokov's unfinished novel. So like O'Connor, he died in the middle of writing a novel. It was called The Original of Laura. And this was big literary news. And I mentioned to a professor of mine who was a scholar of Nabokov, who got me into Nabokov. I said, aren't you excited? And he said, I'm not going to read it. And I said, what do you mean you're not going to read it? And he said, Nabokov didn't want us to read it. He did not want us to read it. And I said, okay. So I want to ask you the same thing about O'Connor now. Like, she died in 1964. What would you say to that? Like, about the quote unquote ethics of presenting to the world pieces of something that she did not presumably want us to read?
Yeah, well, I think that it's different because as far as we know, she probably did want us to read it. Now, she didn't want us to read it necessarily in this form that came out because there's no way she could have foreseen this. But even at the end of her life, when she was in the hospital room and she didn't have time to revise some of the short stories that she was working on, she sent letters to her agent and to her editor, Robert Giroux, saying, just publish stuff. I don't have time to work on it. She really thought, I mean, she took, you know, the last rites. She thought there's no way I'm going to have time for this. She knew that death was coming. And she said, publish, publish, publish. So there's this idea that at least when she was saying publish these short stories, that same kind of principle could probably apply to the novel in progress. There's nothing direct. There's nothing explicit that said she wanted that out there. But I do think Flannery wanted things out there. I don't think Flannery had the same kind of arrogance regarding her work where she would have demanded perfection even of herself, no matter how much she strived for excellence. And so, you know, I also took Michael Peach's take on The Pale King, where he said, David Foster Wallace is not here to tell us no, so all we can do is ask his forgiveness. And so I think there's that too. So if I'm wrong and Flannery did not want this out, then I hope she forgives me.
Well, that's a great point because we all know from the biographies that she was editing right in her hospital bed, hiding things under her pillow from the nurses. She was working right really until the last moments of her life.
Yes. Her work was of utmost priority. I mean, everybody who knows Flannery well knows that when she went to Lourdes and wanted, you know, people wanted her to pray for her health, she prayed for her books. So she was always dedicated to her work. She wanted them to come out well. And I hope that I did justice in being able to say, this is unfinished. You know, don't judge her according to finished material. But at the same time, what can we gain by looking at the unfinished and remembering always that it is unfinished?
Tell our listeners what the volume actually contains.
Sure. We call it a literary excavation, which I think is a really great phrase. It's apt for what this is. What we had was 378 pages of unfinished material. So this was scenes that Flannery typed again and again and again. There's about 15 approximately rough scenes that she was working on. We don't have any understanding of how she would have connected them, whether she was just doing these biographical sketches to kind of unpack some of her characters, whether it would have all ended up in the novel, whether none of it would have ended up in the novel. But at the end of the day, that's what she left. And so even Flannery's work is usually like down to the sentence, down to the word, she's being precise. And we do not get that kind of sense with her prose. There's a lot of grammatical mistakes even in these pages and things that she would have been able to fix and finish and make smooth. But at the same time, we get to see these character sketches and we get to see these ideas that she was working with. And a lot of that material, I think, is helpful for unpacking who Flannery was and who she could have become, that helps us see her more as an unfinished story instead of judging her as a finished package.
Talk about the plot, such as it is, of the novel, because the way it's arranged is you have things like, you know, you get the porch scene, and then you get the porch scene, and then we get some of, you know, Jessica Houghton Wilson talking about the scene,
right. Kind
of what comes next, right? So as much as there is, because people have asked me, what's the plot? And I'm like, well, there's definitely like something implied there, but tell our listeners kind of like what the rough, what you make it out of it.
Sure. You know, because the story doesn't get going, what I did instead was try to create a story of the woman and her material behind the story. So I invite readers almost to become a character while they're reading this work. And so I begin the story with my story of finding out about this material and going to look at the material and kind of putting readers in my position of, okay, the story is, who are we as Flannery O'Connor readers in addressing this material, as well as who was the artist and what did she intend? So we're kind of putting those puzzle pieces together. So the full story is my experience with the work, her material, which I can talk about now, and then us as readers, where do we go from here? And how do we continue the things that she wanted us to do with her work? So the story itself doesn't actually get started. It's more like if you have ever charted a novel in a high school literature class and you get the background and there's a catalyst and it starts the rising action. Well, we get up to a catalyst that might happen, and that's all you get. And so we have the background really set up. People, these scenes, kind of the porch scene, as you mentioned, the girl coming on her way. What we have is Walter Tillman, who is the quintessential Flannery O'Connor, intellectual, Southern type, at home with his family, living on a farm, even though he's gone away and had education. And now what does he do with his life? And he writes letters to people all over the country, very condescending letters, in which he puts on personas and pretends to be other people that match his correspondence desires or worldview. And when he does this, I mean, it's kind of like a Twitter troll, right? I mean, this is very, it feels very contemporary when you're reading it, that he like plays these games with people. And one of the people that he plays games with is Una Gibbs, who is a civil rights activist in the Northeast. And she has just broken through the ceiling of religion. She embraces all people. She loves all people. And Walter Tillman decides to test this love by making love to her through the mail as a Black man. So I call it epistolary blackface, in which he's pretending to be Black in order to test her affection. And then, of course, she's on her way to meet him and show him that she really does love him, even though he's Black and she's white. And then, of course, they don't meet. And that's where we are.
Yeah, I did think to myself that if I were to teach this, I would teach it as two novels going out at once, like the fragments of the novel about Walter, but also the quote unquote novel of Jessica Houghton Wilson trying to assemble all these things together, because they both have like a narrative arc, right? So let's talk about your novel, so to speak. You know, you are my daughter would call a Flan fan. You are a true Flan fan. It must have been incredible, like to get the nod and say, okay, you're going to go through all these manuscripts. Pages, like, what was that like?
Yeah, I was thrilled. I mean, when I found out there was a third novel, I mean, I just thought nothing greater will happen in my lifetime. I remember I even said that to somebody who was, you know, a well-seasoned poet, and he's like, other things will happen to you. It'll be like, this is not like the epitome, but it felt like it really did. It felt like this is the epitome of my entire career. is discovering this novel. And so then to be able to say, the estate say, like, yes, like, we give you full permissions to look at this work, to go through this work. We want you to do this. And to be able to work with her estate that closely was just amazing for me, to really get to feel like I was in O'Connor's world. And I was in Milledgeville so much for several years, walking through her cemetery over and over again, getting to see all the places that she lived and walked regularly, really trying to imitate her style, to write like her, to copy, you know, what words were most common with her language, just getting to see her from the inside out rather than as an object of study, which is, I think, what I did mostly in graduate school, was more like object study, and instead being like, okay, how can I internalize O'Connor? How can I see the world the way that she saw it? And it was a different process, one that I think really transformed even the way that I see anything now.
You mentioned in the introduction, or in one of your notes in the book, you mentioned that there was, however, a whole group of people who were kind of like, nothing to see here. Not like, and of course, I'm like, what are you talking about? There's nothing to see here. It's an unpublished novel by Flannery O'Connor, right? So did anybody kind of tell you that? Did you meet any of those voices?
Oh, yeah, a lot. Well, even taking this to publication, I mean, there were a couple people, you know, two or three publishers kind of competing over who's going to get to publish this. But at the same time, there were a lot of rejections too, where it's like, no, there's nothing to see here. And people that just said, like, this is just fragments. It barely gets going. Why would anyone want to see this? What's the story here? So there was a lot of pushback because you don't get the full piece. I mean, I think there's a sense that publishers had where we published this and people would be nothing but disappointed because they thought, a novel of Flannery's. And then wait, it's not, it's an unfinished novel. It's a work in progress. And it would be kind of a letdown and the book would go nowhere. So I've been surprised by how many people just really are excited after hearing so many people that have been naysayers over the last 10 years or so.
That's true. Because once you love a writer, everything about that writer becomes interesting. Like, you know, their takeout list, their whatever it is, it's like, that all becomes interesting, right? So let's talk about how the Brazos Press got this, because you mentioned Robert Giroux before, and as you know, Farrar-Stouts and Giroux, they published everything she wrote. They published a prayer journal. So how did this particular publisher end up getting what I think is, you know, this literary prize?
So I had talked to FSG because they always get first right of refusal, and they said this is a book by Jessica Houghton Wilson. This is not a book by Flannery O'Connor, which I completely understand. I was honored that I even had any communication with them, because for someone like me to get to talk to FSG was like, this is great. Thank you for talking to me. But at the same time, there wasn't enough Flannery here for them to publish it as Flannery's work. And so that started conversations with publishers outside of FSG. But it was still a fun conversation to have, and they were definitely interested in the material that was left behind. But it was a Jessica Houghton Wilson book, which is a different thing. And since I'd already published two books with Brazos, that's what I decided to stay with for this one while I was working on these other books with Brazos.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because you said like it's not a Flannery book, but when I read it and I read the whole thing like, you know, in a day, because I couldn't put it down, it reminded me of how much like you miss her voice. Like her voice is definitely there, right? I mean,
yeah.
It was like when the new Beatles song came out of Now and Then, and it kind of makes you sad. You're like, oh man, the Beatles were so great. But did you find that experience of like reading these manuscripts? It's like, that's her voice.
Yeah. Well, I started working on this material before I'd ever gotten a nod published. So I was in the archives just thinking, you know, what is this? I want to read it for myself. And as I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, this is so good. This, you know, the moment where Walter is reading this letter and sitting on a rock and he sees all these exclamation points and he's like, exclamation points are a sign of hysteria, you know, and it's just so Flannery. And he reads it and there's these theological errors in this woman's work. And he's like, good God in hell. And I'm like, oh, only Flannery can do that kind of juxtaposition, you know?
She talks at one point about Walter's sister. Her name is Mary Maud, and it says she thought the whole world was her first grade.
There's
like so many Flannery, like I was laughing, so many Flannery one-liners in there that I was like, I can't believe this was like hidden in a box somewhere. So let's talk a little more. You said that Walter is like the quintessential Flannery character, right? And he certainly reminds us of Asbury from The Enduring Chill, or Hulga, certainly from Good Country People. And, you know, he also made me think of Raber from The Violent Bear and Away. Like, talk a little bit about, like, you know, Flannery and the intellectuals. Like, they always get the same kind of treatment in her books.
Yeah, I think, you know, when Flannery went off to go to school in Iowa and she was kind of going out to become a celebrated writer, and then she went to Yaddo and she, you know, she was in New York and Connecticut. And so she's getting to experience the world. When she came back to the South, I think she was worried about it killing her career. And instead, she discovered, okay, this is actually where my stories are. What does it look like to be the one who goes out and sees the world and then comes back home to see your own place through that lens? So she had this benefit of being both an insider and an outsider in her world. And that kind of perspective is very helpful for the artist, right? Not the outsider who goes away and lives in exile. That's a different kind of story that gets told. But the outsider who can actually see, okay, where are the problems, but where are the goods? How can I see both regularly? It takes a lot of nuance. To me, that's where genius really lies. So when we get to see the world through Flannery's eyes, we're getting access to then, okay, how do I do that with my own life? How do I do this insider-outsider thing? So her intellectual characters are really Flannery walking around on the page, I think. I think that's the most biographical characters we get are these intellectuals that return home.
Really? Because that's kind of a surprising thing to say about Flannery, right? Because, right? Because she seems to treat them with such scorn. Like I'm thinking of like Julian.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But that's the thing about Flannery. You know, if you read her letters, she's regularly saying like, I don't let myself off the hook. I mean, that's not a direct quote, but it's that kind of language where she says, no, I mean, I see these foibles. They are my own. Yeah. These are the problems. And again, that's what makes a great genius. You look at someone like Dostoevsky, you know, somebody else I write on all the time. And Dostoevsky says he puts his own self into the characters on the page, not because they're perfect. He doesn't heroize himself, right? And he doesn't villainize himself. He's able to say, like, each human being is full of these good and bad things. And so when we see Walter Tillman, he is not treated only negatively, nor is he uplifted as just being this positive example to society. And Flannery didn't see herself that way, right? She saw herself full of her own sins and her own monsters.
That's great, because she, the thing we love about Flannery O'Connor that kind of drew us all to her, I think at the beginning, was like, she really sucker punches the reader. Like she draws you in where you feel totally superior to a character like Julian, say, and everything that rises must converge. And you're like, what a terrible guy this is. And the bus was, and then at the end though, after his mother gets punched, all of a sudden, like you don't really kind of articulate it, but your relationship with Julian is different. Right. Mm-hmm. So she kind of like draws us in. She knows exactly what she's doing to make you feel superior to the grandmother and the violent, a life.
Good man's hard to find.
Good man's hard to find. Right. It's easy to feel superior to her, but then at the end of the story, your relationship is different. Fair enough.
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I've taught Everything Rises Must Converge, I've had most dramatic teaching moments where students who were so hard-hearted, who were feeling for Julian exactly like Julian, and then having that moment at the end. I had one student who'd been hard-hearted for the whole year I taught her, and then cried at the end and was like, "I'm Julian." So I think Flannery does that on purpose, but I think she herself is being as convicted as she is convicting her readers, right? So it's a mutual reciprocal process happening with her art.
Yeah, because if you think you're not in that pool where all the intellectuals are, that's the point, right? That's the point. You're in a glass house.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So let's talk about, you say, when you write about O'Connor and race, you have a quote here, and I want to get your reaction to this. You say, this is from your notes, you say, "If every era suffers from cultural blindness, we cannot assume we are without deficiencies as well." So talk about that a little, and a lot about the treatment of race in this book.
I think that this book, particularly writing in 1963, it's coming out in 2024. So there's this kind of distance that allows us to see with some judgment looking backwards on her. But once we do that, hope we realize that same judgment then should be examined of us, and imagine how 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 years people are going to read us, right? So whatever gaze that we're exhibiting on O'Connor, can we hold ourselves up to that same gaze? And that's what I see when it comes to race on Flannery. You know, you and I were talking about so many of her relatives outlived her by 50, 60 years. Flannery, if she had not had lupus, probably would have had that same life trajectory. And how different she would have been writing now from writing then. And I think we can see that in this story when it comes to race, that she's dealing with these questions and trying to get her intellectual assent to certain things like integration to be an emotional and you know, physical, social proximity. It's a different, the different questions, the different process that she was undergoing there than we've seen in her previous work. And I think that's what's beautiful. And I think that's what's hopeful for the reader to be able to say, okay, where have I been blind to my own ideas and assumptions about reality? And how are other people going to judge me in the future?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Vonage. With Vonage Video API, your developers can easily create custom video experiences tailored to your business. Enhance every conversation with live video, whether it's delivering faster tech support, improving customer service, or enabling interactive meetings and events. Unlock the true video potential of your business. Discover how at Vonage.com.
Add a berry blast off for your day with the new Berry Pebbles. A berry twist on a classic breakfast. Perfect for giving those growing minds a blast of creativity. With a new berry way to Pebbles. Yabba dabba do you with Berry Pebbles. Head to postpebblescereal.com to learn more. Yabba dabba do and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements, copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah, you say at one point in one of your notes, and I thought this was spot on, you say that one thing that Flannery really resented was posturing. She didn't like posturing in other people. And is it fair enough to say then, like, you know, we can't posture now that we finally have everything figured out, and that decades from now, people will say, wow, those people in 2024, they had it all going on.
Yeah. You know, one of the best books I read on that was Breaking Bread with the Dead by Alan Jacobs. And he says something along the lines of, let's just pretend that in 50 to 60 years, people look back and say, they ate meat, they killed animals and ate them. Like, how horrendous. Don't they realize that animals are family, or, you know, something along those lines. Right. And I think that's the same kind of idea. Like, we cannot even fathom the ways that people are going to look back on us and be like, didn't you realize, didn't you know that those kind of things were wrong? Right. So I think that's important to kind of recognize that cultural distance.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, all the Flannery characters, so many of them do think they don't go that way at all. They're like, no, we know exactly what's what, and this is it. And yes, I know what's what. And everyone around me, at one point, I think you'll correct me if I'm wrong, there's one point where it says that Walter, he had a horror of the love of stupid people. Right? He had a horror of the love, which is such a Flannery line. He had a horror of the love of stupid people, because that's who Walter is, right? In his bed, writing letters about what's wrong with the world.
And even his ability to say that there are stupid people in the world, like that kind of posturing, that kind of presumption. And Flannery saw that in herself. There's so many times where she's uncharitable, and she'll see it in her letters and be like, I know this is uncharitable. Like, I know that this is wrong of me. I have enough awareness to say, like, I shouldn't say these things. And yet I'm saying these things in my work, you know?
Yeah.
Or in my personal writing.
Yeah, that's great. When you read The Habit of Being and stuff, and you get all those glimpses of her in the letters where she really is very hard on herself. And, you know,
yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, O'Connor says in one of those letters, you know, that all of her stories are about the action of grace on a character who's not really willing to support it. I think it's a great line. Mm-hmm. And you point out that Walter in the book, in these fragments, is very much like Asbury in The Enduring Chill, where, you know, and in The Enduring Chill, though, like many O'Connor characters, Asbury has this moment of grace kind of at the climax. But this one's a little different. So can you talk about if you could tell our listeners about the quote unquote traditional structure of an O'Connor story, and how this is a little different.
Yeah. So Flannery says in her last letters, she says, I'm at the point where I do not think that I can keep doing what I've always done, but I have to do something different. And one of the things that she wants to do is she says that she wants God not to come in like lightning, but God to come in like the still small voice talking to Elias in a cave. And so she knows what she's trying to do. She's going to try to change it up. And I really think this was affected, and this is my theory, I don't know if I'm wrong, by her having a TV in her home. As silly as that sounds, it's like she had these shocking violent stories that made more sense to startle her readers than when she got a television in her home and JFK is shot on her TV. I mean, there's an awareness of like, this kind of violence is not the thing to work on my readers anymore. It has to be some other way of getting at them, because people are going to be seeing violence regularly. Now, how can they approach the still small voice? Like, what, God's going to have to talk to them in a different way, right? And so in this story, as opposed to her other works, where her other works have this rising action up to this moment in which truth becomes this, you know, book in the face revelation, right? The human development book striking Mrs. Turpin down, or it's the goring by the bull, you know, Mrs. May getting attacked by the bull on her farm. We had violent intrusion to get the characters out of their own self-congratulation, self-righteous stance towards the world. And instead, Flannery is going to start the narrative. So it's not going to be the climax. We're not going to get to that point. We're going to begin. And how does a character who then hears the still small voice of God live a different life than he had previously lived? She says at one moment when writing a friend in a letter, she said, all people getting baptized as adults is as strange to me as seeing Lazarus come out of a grave, right? Like, there's something startling about those who are converted as adults. And I think she's trying to get at that kind of conversion and show the comic insanity, but also the comic beauty of that kind of conversion for Walter.
That's great, because as you were speaking, I kept thinking of other Flannery leads who have this violent intrusion, right? So who have this moment. So like Hazel Motes in Wise Blood has his big moment. He blinds himself and wraps himself in barbed wire. But then, you know, a couple weeks later, they find him in a ditch. And
yeah.
You think about Tarwater at the end of The Violent Barred Away. Okay, he's been shaken up, but then he just kind of like walks to the city where the children of God lay sleeping, and you assume things won't go well for him. But you know, there's no The Violent Barred Away Part 2 where you find out what happened.
Yes, right. Yeah. And so I think this novel was going to be that. I think this novel was, and I say in the work that I also believe, because of what J.F. Powers writes her, right? J.F. Powers was the National Book Award winning Catholic writer, and he says, stop killing your characters off, right? Before things get interesting. And so I think she does save them after that Powers letter and thinks, okay, how would it get interesting? Yeah. What would happen if Grace descended on Asbury and the Enduring Chill, and then write the rest of it? So this story to me is like part two of the Enduring Chill.
Yeah, it is. It very much feels that way, right? Because you keep waiting for the violence in these pages, but there isn't any. It's, you know, there isn't any at all. And it's funny what you said before, we talked about the grandmother. So in A Good Man Is Hard to Find, right? That's her most anthologized story. It's the Flannery O'Connor 101. But when you read that first, as many of us did, like, that kind of sets our expectations for all the other ones. But this one didn't, because I kept waiting for for those big moments. But
yeah.
They're all him like kind of seething and like being angry and things like that. So
absolutely.
So let's I was wondering if you could read us something from this. If you could read us the passage where Walter admits kind of that he has to believe in God. It's on
I love that you assume that I have the book with me.
Okay. Well, if you don't, we can talk about the passage. We can talk about
it. Why don't you, would you be willing to read the passage?
Sure. I'll read a little bit and I'll get your reaction from it. So this is kind of like, you know, Walter has this conversion and he thinks that, you know, you say Una has abrogated the place of God. And then kind of Walter says, all right, I got to do it. So I'll read it and I'll get your reaction. Okay. He says, she says, I'm sorry. He had not up until that moment had been a believer. But he realized then, with a shudder, that he was a Christian bound for hell. His throat had gone instantly dry, his face had grown pale, and it looked as if the countryside had dropped away from the rock he had sat on, and he and the rock were suspended over nothing. Walter knew the fathers of the church. He had assisted at Nicaea and at Chalcedon. He had explored the intricacies of light with Bonaventure. He knew where Aquinas and Duns Scotus would part company. He had seen the path turned downward with Abelard and Illogic enter, grandly eloquent with Luther. He had been active at Trent. He had adhered always to the most orthodox line, but never once, never for the slightest moment, had it occurred to him, even remotely, to believe any of it, or that there was the least danger of his doing so. Only now, it simply appeared the accomplished truth. Grace originated elsewhere, and grace was. It mattered, and worse, the woman mattered.
Yeah. So I actually think this is the best understanding of race in Flannery. And the reason I say that is she shows a character that has been studying all these things, looking at all the arguments of the church, really considering things objectively, but from a distance that didn't infringe on his own life and the way he lived. And I think this is Flannery with race, where she had looked at all these things, considered them, agreed with all them. All human beings are made in the image of God. And then there's these moments of revelation with, if everyone's made in the image of God, then why are some people all being used as field hands and servants and maids? And why are we treating people this way? And it's this moment of revelation, like, people matter. African Americans around me should be my friends. I should worship with them. Why are they worshiping in a Black Catholic church and I'm in a white Catholic church? I think this is the same kind of parallel of what's happening with Flannery. But she's drawing it for Walter becoming a believer and realizing, like, how do you love other people then? Especially stupid people, quote unquote, stupid people that, you know, like for Una, like he's been so condescending. So how do you love someone that you see yourself as above? And what is that going to mean for him to be able to lower himself down? And that's going to take work. And I think that's what the novel was trying to show, is like, what would be the work of that kind of life?
That's what Raber tries to resist with his son, Bishop, right? He tries to, he knows he's supposed to love his own son, but he can't because he says Bishop is a symbol of everything he hates about the universe.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of love for Bishop would require him to be selfless, would require him to be empathetic, would require him to not be proud. I mean, it would just, that kind of love is a fearful thing.
Yeah, you know? It is, because it's so pure. That's why Bishop is so scary, so frightening to Tarwater. When he reaches out and Tarwater slaps his hands away, because Bishop is so good. Like, you know, we're used to reading literary portrayals of evil that's terrifying, but in Flannery, like, goodness is terrifying as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and she gets that from Graham Greene. Graham Greene says, a man like me would run a mile to get away from that kind of love, right? The intensity of that kind of love.
Yeah. C.S. Lewis says somewhere that it's funny, people say they would love to see an angel, but he says every time mention, every time they're in the Bible, the first thing the angel says is, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid.
Yeah. Well, and I know you know this, but Flannery used to say that when she was little and somebody told her there was a guardian angel, she would go into the bathroom and turn circles with punches, and she was trying to punch away her guardian angel. So I love that too.
The other great thing about that passage, it reminded me of just reading it now, was that the dead certainty that God is speaking to you and that kind of God wins. And it's very much, again, like in The Violet Berry Way, when Tarwater just knows that he's got to be this prophet. Like, he wants the burning bush. He wants the sun to stand still because he's a 13-year-old kid. He wants to be dramatic, right? But he's just kind of like, I love that moment where he just knows that he's got to baptize Bishop. He just knows he's got to do it. It's like surrender, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So last question, but a big one, and we'll see where this goes. So why Flannery O'Connor? Like, why do we still need her? Why should we still be reading her more than ever, maybe? But, you know, people ask you, who's this Flannery O'Connor? Like, why do we need to read her?
Yeah, I think there's a secular answer and a Christian answer. So I lean towards the Christian answer from my background, that Flannery is one of those writers who convicts me of the enchanted nature of the world. And we live in such a disenchanted age that the idea that things matter, that they have eternal and spiritual significance, is just on the surface in her work, whereas a lot of people hide it or they remove it entirely. Some of the best writers, you know, you only get the sense that things are symbols or motifs, and it becomes this literary objectivity. But Flannery just smacks you in the face with, no, these things matter. People matter. People are souls. And it's just, it's that kind of beauty that I've always found so attractive and so necessary in our age. On a secular answer, for those who, you know, the belief in Christ is not a matter of life and death, as Flannery says in her note to Wiseblood, for those who don't believe that, there's also a sense, though, that if we judge the truth rather than have the truth judge us, we end up with violence. And Flannery saw this, and it sounds extreme, but you see it in our own culture. This very idea that you are above the truth means that other people can be dehumanized as ignorant or evil, and they can be dismissed, they can be mistreated, they can be attacked on Twitter or attacked in real life. Like, this is the point where Flannery said, once we have cut off tenderness from the source of tenderness, we end in the gas chambers. We lose our ability to suffer people's foibles, to suffer our own, because we have this kind of high exalted stance. And so Flannery doesn't allow for hypocrisy on that level, right? And I think that's one of those things that's regularly convicting about her work, is that she demands that, like, whatever you truly believe, you better walk behind. And if not, then to her, that means you're possessed, you know, like you have a demon possessing you, and she's going to exorcise you of it, right? Like, whatever level of pride has taken over you, and you've lost the ability to see other people, or to see the truth well.
Right. Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress is published by Brazos Press. It's available everywhere. And if you love the work of Flannery O'Connor, if you're curious about the work of Flannery O'Connor, you will not want to miss this. Jessica Houghton Wilson, thank you so much.
Thank you.